Great. Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to the ABF Fellows CLE. Our program this morning is entitled Challenges to Democracy in 2024. A clearly totally irrelevant topic that nobody cares about these days. So our panel today will be moderated by Professor Tracy Birch. Tracy Birch is a research professor at the American Bar Foundation and an associate professor of political science at Northwestern University. And if you hear her in any other event ever again, she will not be introduced that way, because as of September 1st, she'll be a full professor of political science at Northwestern. And I said that just to embarrass her. Tracy's research focuses on the intersection between the U.S. criminal justice system, political behavior, and various forms of structural inequality. Her landmark book, Trading Democracy for Justice, Criminal Convictions and the Decline of Neighborhood Political Participation, won multiple awards, including the American Political Science Association's Ralph J. Bunch Award for work on ethnic and cultural pluralism, and the Urban Politics Section's Best Book Award, and the Law and Courts Section's C. Herman Pritchett Award. Tracy is also the co-author of Creating a New Racial Order, which is a groundbreaking exploration of how race in America is being redefined. Her work has been featured in journals such as Political Behavior, The Law and Society Review, Criminology and Public Policy, and many more. And in today's CLE, Tracy will share with us some of her work on the barriers to voter eligibility, and we'll discuss with our other illustrious panelists additional important issues such as political misinformation, electoral violence, and so on. And with that, I will turn it over to Tracy, who will introduce the rest of the panelists.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming out, and thank you to our panelists from coming near and far to have this discussion with us today. And I have the privilege, along with Mark, of welcoming you to this American Bar Foundation CLE panel. And I want to start us off, before I introduce everyone, by framing the motivation behind this panel. And what I want to say is that, I'm sorry this is smaller than I expected it to be, but in the United States, in survey after survey, Americans have said that they are concerned about democracy. So just to read this for you, 64% of American adults agree that they are concerned that extremists will commit acts of violence if they are unhappy with the election. That was in 2022. 42% strongly or somewhat agreed that they were concerned about threats of violence or voter intimidation while voting in person at their polling place. That was also in 2022. More recently, in a survey taken just after the attempted assassination of President Trump on July 14th of this year, this survey was taken on July 14th, 82% of Americans think that political violence is a very big problem or somewhat of a problem in the United States today. And people are looking at this, we can see, from Google searches. So this is Google Trends data just from the term political violence. And we can see they start calculating it differently. But in recent years, we can see that there is some uptick, especially around elections in particular moments, such as in the spring with campus protests, and then this big spike at the end, which is what happened after the attempted assassination of President Trump. We see that people are starting to look for these, look at terms like political violence on and show interest in that over time as well. But it's not just limited to violence. People also are worried about other aspects of democracy. So lots of surveys ask this question: when it comes to elections in the United States, what concerns you more? 46% said they were concerned that some people will cast votes illegally, and 48% said that some eligible voters won't have a fair chance to vote. So these twin things, some people are concerned more about voter fraud, others are concerned more about voter suppression. but they're all concerned about illegitimacy, democratic illegitimacy. And there's also, when we unpack that concern about people who are eligible not being allowed to vote, that is voter suppression, 40% of Americans think this is a major problem, and 36% think it's a minor problem. So there's still people who are open to and somewhat, at least somewhat concerned about the idea. 3/4 of Americans are somewhat concerned about the idea that eligible people will be prevented from voting. So today's plan in this panel is to learn more about the scholarship and the work that's being done to address, to study, to understand these areas of concern. So I will start by presenting a little bit about my very new ABF project on vote denial. We also have Alexandra Philindra, who is an associate professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's a political scientist, and she is going to talk to us about her most recent work on political violence and elected officials. Professor Philindra is the author of several books and articles, including Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and America's Gun Culture, and she's also the editor of the Journal of Race, Ethnicity, and Politics. We also will hear from Ray Block, who is the Brown McCourtney Career Development Professor in the McCourtney Institute of Democracy, and he's a joint faculty member in political science and African American studies at Penn State University. And Ray also, though, works at the RAND Corporation as the Michael D. Rich Distinguished Chair for Countering Truth Decay. And his research interests include racial, ethnic, and gender group politics, voting behavior, and public opinion in the United States. And he will be here to talk about misinformation or truth decay. And finally, Brandon Jones is director of political campaigns at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He spent 15 years in private practice in Mississippi, where he is licensed, and he's a former member of the Mississippi legislature and a campaign manager for several campaigns. He taught at Millsaps College as well and was on the Mississippi Board of Bar Commissioners. And he also wanted me to mention that he has 3 kids, one of whom is here today. So after we present, I will pose a couple of questions to spark discussion amongst the panelists, and then we will turn to questions from the audience. So get your pens and questions ready. So I'll start by telling you a little bit about my current ABF project that the work of the fellows and others are supporting. And so my new project, like I said, it's early, and it is it's about the verification of voter eligibility. And all of you have experienced, hopefully, the process of registering to vote. And I have here Illinois, just as an example of what's required of people who want to register to vote. You can register at the DMV when you sign up for a driver's license. You can register at another state agency. And all states have some kind of eligibility requirements for registering to vote. The ones at Illinois are at the bottom. It says you must be a United States citizen, you must be at least 17 years old on or before the date of the primary election and turn 18 before the date of the general election. You must live in your election precinct at least 30 days prior to election day. You must not be serving a sentence of confinement in any penal institution as a result of a conviction. You may not claim the right to vote anywhere else. So all of these, of course, this is Illinois, but these requirements vary by state. Some states may not allow people who've been convicted of a felony to vote, either while they're serving their sentence or ever. Some states even have requirements with respect to mental capacity or mental fitness written into their statutes about registering to vote. So in every state, there are rules for how voters prove that they meet these eligibility criteria, and these eligibility rules also vary by state. And this is what I'm interested in studying. So in some states, in order to register, you have to provide proof that you're a citizen. So you saw that requirement that you have to be a citizen in order to vote. At least on the federal form, most people do this by attestation. But some states, in order to vote in state and local elections, also require you to provide documentary proof of citizenship. That is a certified birth certificate or passport, some of which people might provide when they're getting a driver's license. But if you haven't provided that information when you're getting a driver's license in those states, then you have to come up with those documents in order to prove your citizenship in order to vote. Other states that might have a question about whether a person is a citizen, even if they don't have a documentary proof requirement, may request proof if there's some question about whether a person is a citizen. You also have to provide proof of identity. Sometimes that's a government-issued photo ID, but it can also be a Social Security card, sometimes tax forms. States vary into what they accept as proof of identity. You have to provide proof of residency. So when they ask you to bring a bill or a statement, a bank statement or a lease, you have to prove that you actually live both in the state but in the precinct. So you have to prove your address so that you're voting in the right precinct for the right offices. Finally, if you have a felony conviction, you may need to provide proof of your status. So have you finished serving your sentence and finished the requirements of your sentence? And so you might see people having to rules. You're starting to see more and more rules where people have to provide paperwork or get some kind of certification that they meet these requirements. So you might think this is not a big deal. Why are you studying this? So it turns out that proving eligibility can be very difficult for certain classes of individuals. So there may be situations in which electronic systems that states use to verify new voters might flag some people for additional paperwork and not others. So they may do that in a way that isn't fair. And then they might require people to provide more documentation of their eligibility than just going to the DMV with a driver's license and a bill. Documentary proof, providing that documentary proof might cost time and money. So if, you think about the fees for certified copies of birth certificates or marriage licenses, especially if you are married and change your name, or naturalization paperwork, which can actually cost hundreds or thousands of dollars if they're unable to verify your naturalization paperwork. For people who need to prove that they have satisfied a requirement that they've paid their court costs or that they have gotten an expungement, for instance, there are fees. All of you know there are fees for printing court records, especially certified copies. You may be waiting a while to get birth certificates. Processing times in some states can be as high as I think the highest I've seen so far was California during the pandemic was 10 months. So if you were requesting an out-of-state birth certificate, certified birth certificate, they had on their website, you would be waiting for a very long time. And then you might also have to do in-person visits to county clerks or other offices. So for some people, I've actually been and heard people who've had to go back and forth to these offices multiple times and say things like, well, I got to take time off work again to go down to this office and get this paper signed. Documentary proof of residency can be particularly difficult on Native American reservations and other rural places where people don't receive mail at home. So not everybody has a post office that where the mail carrier comes to their house. They may live on a rural route, or again, a lot of people on reservations don't even have standardized addresses in ways that we might think of a postal address. DPOR, documentary proof of residency, can also be difficult when a person doesn't head a household. So if you're not on the lease or you don't get the bills in your name, it can be difficult to prove that you live in a place. My favorite way to explain this is think about how an 18-year-old new voter is able to satisfy all of these requirements. So I frame this in terms of administrative exclusion. This is a phrase from Brodkin and Majmudar, which is when organizational practices, both formal and informal, rather than the actual status of eligibility or wanting to participate, affects participation in public programs. So if policies impose high costs or barriers to claiming benefits, for instance, if you don't have a birth certificate, again, recording births is a relatively recent phenomenon. In the 1950s, you know, the census did a study, and less than half of home births, at home births, were even recorded. So people, especially older people, may not have birth certificates certified birth certificates that they can even request. So people might find that they aren't able to participate because they just can't overcome these high barriers to participation. So in my project, I'm collecting data on administrative practices in states that require documentary proof of citizenship, residency, and felony status, and with the aim of answering certain questions like who gets targeted for verification and how is eligibility verified. Is it the responsibility of the state or the county? Who pays for the documents? Does the voter have to pay for the documents? What kinds of documents are acceptable? And are these documents available? They may also see questions about what kinds of wait or processing times they're facing. You may also see questions about decision making. So the burden of proof, who's deciding and how are they making the determination? So I've been part of court cases, for instance, where you're trying to use find school records, and people are deciding whether this school record is enough to say, yes, this person was born in the United States and was a citizen. And is there an appeals process? What does it look like if a determination is made? If there are errors, is there a system of redress? So I am collecting data right now because this is the election season and I'm waiting for the world to unfold and generate data. So hopefully I can collect data and analyze it. And by the time the next ABF panel rolls around, I will be able to tell you more about what I found. But for now, I will leave it for Professor Philindra.
Thank you, Tracy, and I am very excited to be here with all of you. Oh, from here, okay. There we go. So I'm a professor of political science at the University of Illinois here in Chicago. So for you who are not from our fair city, welcome. And thank you for showing up this early to discuss some very bleak things that are happening in our democracy. I study mostly gun politics in the United States, and that work has brought me to the issue of political violence. And I am a scholar of race, ethnicity, and politics, and therefore I'm very, very keenly interested and sensitive to how does political violence, as other forms of violence too, but in this case political violence, affect women and people of color in office. And as part of this project, we are looking at what motivates political violence against such groups, the prevalence of such violence, and what are some of the consequences for elected officials? I have to say that it's not just elected officials who have been facing forms of harassment, threats, and violence in this country. I am sure that within your profession, you have seen judges, prosecutors, and others who have faced similar experiences. So the issue is not limited to people in elective office. It's broader, and it can affect multiple aspects of a democratic society. It's very serious. When we talk about political violence, we use definitions that come from official sources, like, for example, the World Health Organization defines political violence as the deliberate use of power and force to achieve political goals. So the aim of political violence is to change the behavior of political actors in a way that is consistent with the perpetrator's goals. And as such, it can take different forms. It can be physical violence, which is what we saw a few weeks ago in Butler, Pennsylvania, or it can take psychological violence, psychological forms and mental forms. Obviously, physical violence is far more serious, with far more serious consequences, but we cannot underestimate the effects of psychological violence on people. And it can involve a variety of actors. Scholars of international affairs tell us that it can involve state actors, such as police and intelligence services in authoritarian states. There are militia groups that can use violence. There are terrorist organizations. But even regular citizens like you and me can become radicalized and perpetrate acts of violence and use threats and become harassing and create a lot of problems with elected officials. Political violence can be motivated specifically by a desire to maintain a hierarchical system based on race and gender. It's not the only thing that can motivate political violence, but it's not a rare thing. For example, we have studies that show that in Bolivia, when a gender parity law was passed there, the number of attacks against women in elective office increased significantly. And scholars attribute this to the law itself, that people were responding to the law that elevated women to parity by actually attacking women politicians and trying to put them back in their place, essentially. In the United States, we saw a similar phenomenon a century ago with the huge numbers of lynchings that accompanied the return of black soldiers from Europe in 1919. This has been well documented by a variety of organizations and scholarly work by now, and it's a very, very sad time in American history. A lot of the pictures that accompany this presentation are pictures that elected officials sent us. So they're original things that happened to them from attacks that happened to them. They are very upsetting, some of them, so this is a trigger warning. So political violence may have also, in addition to being motivated by race or gender, it can be motivated by other things like ideology or other causes, personal causes, but it can also take forms that are racialized or gendered, that basically use racialized or gendered language, or they target people in terms of their gender and in terms of their race. One form that is especially gendered is, for example, rape or sexual abuse that targets female politicians. We see that a lot outside of the U.S. There have been a lot of documented cases of both female elected officials and female voters that have been targeted with sexual abuse and rape around elections. But what we see mostly in the U.S. is targeted language and messaging, like this picture, for example, that is very, very gendered or racist. It's sexist, it's misogynistic or racist. It's imagery that we are seeing that is targeting elected officials based on their gender or their race. Even when the motivation of political violence against women and people of color is not targeting them on the basis of their race or their gender, we can have people being affected differently because of their race and gender. First of all, we know that people of color and women are considered more approachable. My students are more likely to come to me with all kinds of questions because they think that I am nice, rather than go to male professors who appear to have a more authority and more distant persona. The same happens in politics. People are more likely to approach female politicians, to approach people of color in politics, because they see them as more approachable. As a result, they're more likely to complain to them. Complaints can escalate to very disturbing behavior. Also, women and people of color tend to receive a lot more requests for constituency services because they're approachable, because they're nice, and because people think that they're the ones who should be providing help rather than men. And also, women and people of color tend to be elected in districts that are more urban and have more needs. There is higher levels of poverty. There is more need for services. We see here in Chicago that we have elected officials who are dealing with homelessness, who are dealing with acute mental health crisis. The COVID era was incredibly affected a great deal people who were elected officials in the area just because of the sheer demand for their time and the misery that they had to deal with and the support that they needed to provide. In addition to all this, the feeling scared about the disease itself, it was all the stuff that they had to do, which was very difficult. So how does it affect people? First, exposure to threats and violence has individual consequences, but it also has group consequences. In terms of individual consequences, they can be things like desensitization. We heard people say, well, this is politics. This is the way it is. They're trying to sort of distance themselves and create a barrier from these experiences by sort of minimizing them and desensitizing themselves from that, which is very, very dangerous, actually. At the same time as these processes of desensitization take place, we see people express high levels of anxiety and even PTSD. So on one hand, they dismiss it as, it's not happening, it's not very important. On the other hand, they don't sleep at night. We see people who are using harmful coping behaviors. People who are telling us, I'm eating a lot more. I'm smoking now. I started smoking again. My colleagues are drinking a lot more in a way to cope with all of this. And also we're seeing antisocial behavior, people becoming more aggressive, less empathetic, and more willing to, less willing to help others. And the definition of an elected official is to provide service to others. It's a work of service. It's a work of commitment to the community. If you start being unsympathetic, unempathetic, and not caring about others, that is very problematic for service, especially at the local and the state levels. And we see also a decline in work performance. People don't care anymore. And we see that a lot in staff. And staff are very important when it comes to supporting political office. Elected officials don't work alone. They have staffers who do a lot of the day-to-day work. And when these staffers become overwhelmed, that is a problem for many reasons. And then we see at the group level animosity towards the other party that is perceived to be the cause of this misery, that is perceived to be the people who are instigating this type of threats and violence. Other key consequences, the key consequences of political violence can also be very different or more acute for women and people of color. This is because, in part, we know that women and people of color are more sensitive to risk and to threat than are white men. And I saw that a lot in my interviews with elected officials. I had actually one elected official told me, oh, I don't care about any of that. I am not affected. Everywhere I go, I take my two good friends with me, Smith and Wesson. You don't see that from women and people of color. Women and people of color may also experience stronger effects, psychological consequences from this, and they may be more likely as a result to change their political behaviors, and we'll go more into that, and also staying in politics. So what have we seen in terms of data? These are data from the U.S. Capitol Police from last year, and as you can see, over the past several years, the number of threats and violence against elected officials has increased exponentially, and it's back up again this year. So this is only at the congressional level. They are tracking Congress, and because we can't FOIA Congress is an exception, we can't get our hands on the details of these data, so we're relying on what Congress tells us. And what the U.S. Capitol Police is telling us is that these are equal by party, so there isn't a partisan difference here. But there are differences by region. Apparently, people in Florida are getting more of these than in other places, but they're not giving us more details about what's happening. These are data at the local level that are collected by Bridging the Divides Initiative at Princeton University and the ADL. It's a collaborative project. And what we see here, they're collecting data every 3 months, and they're asking people every 3 months, local elected officials, about insults, threats, and harassment and actual attacks. And as you can see, a very large number of people report, like a third of all elected officials at the local level report being harassed and threatened, like 20% report being threatened. And this is done every 3 months and asked about the 3 months prior, not lifetime in politics. So you can extrapolate from this to think how much people are experiencing threats and harassment and insults in their political life overall, because this is like each incident is about every 3 months. In terms of the geography of this, essentially wherever there are populations, large populations of people and elected officials, you get these types of events. They're concentrated in the Northeast, but you can see them in the Southeast and then in California and everywhere. Wherever there are people, there are threats and violence against their elected officials. And we see, of course, that actually what's happening is that people are more worried about exposure to violence than they're experiencing violence. And they're beginning to become really worried about attacks. As you can see, the actual incidence of attacks is about 1%. But the people who fear that they will be attacked, physically attacked, is 14%. And I am pretty sure that when the next batch of data comes out by the end of the summer, this will have jumped as a result of what happened this summer. So people are really, really worried about violence in addition to being exposed in great numbers to threats and violence. What we see is that violence is reported by both parties almost equally. Democrats are a little bit more likely to feel insulted, to experience insults than our Republicans, but when it comes to more serious things like harassment and threats and actual attacks, there is no party difference. Democrats, Republicans, and independents, because remember at the local level they're independents, are equally likely to say, yeah, I have experienced these things. But we see that women are far more likely to report all of these, more likely to be insulted, more likely to be harassed, more likely to be threatened, and the same goes for people of color. Minorities and women have higher incidence, higher prevalence of threats and violence in politics. Based on our qualitative data, we have interviewed about 110 elected officials at the local and state level and their staff. The kinds of things that they report to us are assaults, basically having their homes shot at, having their homes vandalized. These are pictures from vandalism of somebody's house. That people are basically bringing guns and bullets to their houses. People are accosting their kids at school. There is stalking behavior. There is, I'm sure, all of these fall under the criminal code somewhere. There is racist, anti-Semitic, hate crimes type of behavior. It is very, very serious things that people report to us. From these qualitative interviews, what we gather is that ideological motivations is part of this, and there is a lot of that going on, but it's not the only reason why our fellow citizens become threatening and become violent against the elected officials. In urban areas, especially where there is a problem of service provision, mental health crisis is a key problem, where people are experiencing acute mental health problems in combination with housing concerns, and they become very agitated and they can become violent as a result of their situation. But when you are trying to help and you're faced with that, it is a huge burden and it's very dangerous. Another category that people talked a lot about that is not discussed as much in the literature and also in political life is the problem of lack of civic education, which Americans have bounded with a lot of political entitlement. People don't understand how the federal system works because it's complicated, they share powers, and you don't know who does what. So you call your mayor's office with an immigration problem, your mayor is trying to put you through to the federal level and suggest these and these resources, you become agitated and upset because you see these as a sort of being rubbed off, and you're like, oh, I'm bringing down my gun. Some examples of what people are telling us is that a lot of people about how they were threatened with guns, somebody brought a gun to my house, people somebody came to my office and dropped bullets and said, do you know how Joseph Stalin deals with problems? And here are some examples of like racialized and gendered motivations where people were telling us that I was in a Zoom meeting for my election, and they came prepared and they dropped the N-word and lynch into the chat and destroyed the meeting. And we have cases of anti-Semitism. My son was bullied at school, and somebody superimposed his face on a Holocaust, a picture from the Holocaust. So how does this affect people? People show high levels of desensitization, and also they are very affected by the violence. They have a lot of psychological effects, and some of them use gun carry as a coping mechanism. And when it comes to politics, it affects how they deal with issues. They're less likely to co-sponsor bills. They are more likely to say that they're going to retire. They're more likely to say that they are going to stay away from constituents and have large meetings. And another key problem is that everybody is saying they can't recruit new candidates. Nobody wants to run for office having seen what's happening to people today. To close with a little bit more positive news is that people actually who serve in office do so because they care. And because they see it as a duty, they become actually very resilient in the face of this type of experience. And they double down in their on their priorities, and they actually are telling us, no, I am here to do this job, and I'm not going to be deterred, which is good news for democracy. But at the same time, we can't have our political officials, the people who are trying to help our democracy work, operate under conditions like this where their lives and their physical health and their mental health is in such a threat. Thank you.
Good morning. I want to thank everyone for attending this in the morning and listening to, quite frankly, a pretty heavy conversation. So I'm going to add to the heaviness, but I'm also going to end this on what I think is a pretty positive note. And I know I'm preaching to the proverbial choir when it comes to this, but allow me. All right. I am talking to you today as a person who wears a lot of hats, and those hats have names on them. So I'm an endowed professor in two departments at Penn State, and I'm also a distinguished chair at a think tank. What I'm talking to you today combines both of them, but it's mostly about the work that I do at the think tank. And our catchphrase for talking about these and related topics is truth decay. I'll explain what that means in a second. And specifically, I have an outline of what I want to cover. I'll just put this here. Is that I want to demystify what my chairship is, because part of what I do is I raise awareness about truth decay and what RAND's up to. And so I'll be the face of RAND in the truth decay part for today. I also want to discuss the research that's happening, and I'm going to do that thematically. There's a lot of stuff going on. I'm going to break it into broad categories and discuss it that way. And I want to connect, because I am a literal bridge between academia world and think tank world, some of the stuff that's happening that's adjacent to truth decay that is both relevant to the organization at the think tank and to what's happening in academia overall. So my way of talking about TD work here and abroad, so to speak. But before all that, here's a little bit about me. Basically, everything I do can be summarized as me having a concern about the connection between social identity, broadly defined, and political involvement, broadly defined. Social identity can be a lot of stuff. In school, I was studying ethnicity and race and gender, but I also think of ideology and political party as being social identities as well. You can add that to the mix if you like. And for me, political involvement can be behavioral. You can measure, for example, whether people vote. You can look at whether people give money to causes and candidates, and you can also look at whether people protest. But involvement can also be psychological. And my dissertation looked at whether or not people cared about politics. And one of the things that happened is right around 2008, I got my degree in 2006, and at the time, the running conclusion was that black people cared less about politics if you were to compare them to their white neighbors and colleagues. That changed in 2008, and I'll leave it up to you to connect the dots as to why. We took a senator from here, and that person went on to the national scene, right? And so that got me interested in presidents. I am not a presidency study scholar, but I study social identity and political involvement. And I smartened up on political stuff related to the presidency and did a lot of research on both Barack Obama and Michelle Obama as political figures and what that teaches us about race and politics in the USA. When I'm not doing that work, I do state and local politics work, and I have a book that looks at Tennessee politics and looks at the transition of Tennessee from being a swing state, so to speak, to becoming a neon red state, and looking at the processes that made that transition happen around the mid, early to 2010s era, and looking at what the consequences of that political transition were to race relations in the state. Beyond that, I'm a person who's had several family members who have lost their lives to police violence. And even though it's a academic's way of coping, so to speak, I ended up doing a lot of work that looks specifically at police violence as it relates to shootings and fatalities that relate to shootings. That research covers a lot of ground. One of the products of that research is a recent book that some colleagues of mine wrote about Black Lives Matter protests in 2020 and looking at it from a social networks perspective. Again, like you said, I study turnout, for example. If you think of protesting as a political action, our question was, what got people to get off the couch to go out into the streets and protest? And the BLM protests were unique because they weren't primarily black attended. In fact, the modal protester was a white person during the protest of 2020. Now, it was an issue that was directly relevant to African Americans, but it drew a large multiracial and pluriethnic coalition. And that to us was very interesting. And we wanted to understand the mobilizing that went around into it. So this is me in a nutshell. Everything that I just said, contextualize it with what's been going on. So I got to Penn State in 2019, which was just enough time to get settled and then go into lockdown. And my way of coping, again, was to do research that looked at social and political inequalities and connect that to what the public health scholars were doing. The public health research that I was doing was looking at disinformation in the COVID space. And that kind of gets you to where I'm working on the stuff that ran here, which is looking at disinformation. So what am I doing at RAND? I feel like it's easy to break it up into categories and talk about them that way. But first, let's talk about what truth decay is. So the punchline here is, when I say truth decay in here, what I'm talking about, it has disinformation and misinformation as a part of it, but it's bigger than that. What it really is, it's the diminishing role of facts and data and analysis, and I'm going to say also expertise in public life. And public life can be politics. It could be how we speak with one another. It could be education. It could be policy making. It could be health and wellness, and it could be a dozen other things too. So that erosion of those things in public life is what we're concerned about at RAND, and that's what I mean when I say truth decay. As a truth decay chair, I do research on truth decay. So I write research reports that look a lot like the books and chapters and journal articles that academics are familiar with and that they pay attention to. But I also am a program director of sorts. You can imagine a center without a building, and a center director of a non-center, and you have me. I have a small staff, I have a budget, and I have a mission. And I have the autonomy to move around in my organization in a way that makes my position very unique in that regard. So I am the kind of director of a non-center, if you want to think of it that way. I'm also a thought partner, so one of the jobs that I have at RAND is that I support people that are doing work that's related to truth decay. I do that either as a cheerleader, helping them to feel like their work matters and that their work can be supported by my institution. And sometimes when I have resources to devote to people for that research, I give research resources to those people as well. And because I give away a lot of resources, I have to replenish them. So I do a lot of development work in my role as Truth Decay chair. And it's interesting because as an academic, fundraising was grant writing primarily. Like I'd create something on paper, I'd give it to people, I'd go away, those people would make decisions. And if they liked my proposal, they would give me resources. Fundraising now for me is primarily relationship building. It's me giving presentations like this one to people and asking people to bear with me and see whether or not there's enough buy-in for those people to also be excited about or worried about this topic enough to share some of their resources to the cause. I'm a public intellectual now of sorts, which means I write op-eds. I recently had one that came out in the Hill that's related to Truth Decay and race and gender and democracy and things like that. And it's a very different experience from my classic day job as an academic. And when people want to talk about disinformation and they contact RAND, RAND contacts me. So I'm like the external spokesperson for things related to the topic. So this is me in a nutshell. Now the talk itself, get used to seeing this slide. It's going to be here for a while and I'm going to like veer off from it and come back to it. Like I said, disinformation and misinformation, these are things that are part of a broader system. And that system is what I want to talk about when I think about Truth Decay. When it comes to thinking about that system, we at RAND like to think about the drivers of Truth Decay. We like to think about the trends that accompany Truth Decay. And we also like to think about the consequences of Truth Decay. And we have research in all of these areas. When it comes to looking at the drivers of Truth Decay, we're looking at these factors that contribute to the growing of it. One of those factors is cognitive biases that we naturally have. Like we're just more inclined to scrutinize things we don't inherently believe or things that don't fit with our existing beliefs than we are to scrutinize things that sort of fit with our beliefs and our pre-existing ideas. And those psychological processes that kind of make up how we deal with the natural world and how we process information can be exploited for the sake of disinformation and misinformation and things like it. Changes in our information system are a big deal too. A lot of my colleagues care about AI. They care about social media. They care about deep fakes. They care about the ability for things that we know can be falsified to spread like wildfire using technology that allows for that rapid spread. And the changes in our technology often accompany increases in shenanigans. And we've seen this throughout our history. So when newspaper was the primary way that people got their information, we had disinformation then. When radio was added to the list with newspapers, we saw a different opportunity for misinformation to spread. And when television was added to that list, we saw another opportunity. And we are unfortunately in this world where we have all of the previous technologies, but also the internet and social media and things related to it. So it's not a new problem, but it's a increasingly complex problem because of our evolutions in technology. Also, as an educator, I'd be the first to tell you that information literacy and media literacy are really important things to teach, but that aren't guaranteed to be emphasized in K-12 education, and I would argue also in college education. And so these vulnerabilities and how we teach are creating opportunities for more disinformation and more misinformation. And polarization. We have sorting that happens in our society. A lot of that sorting happens on social class lines, but increasingly it's happening on political lines as well. And this political and demographic polarization that we are witnessing creates fertile ground for Truth Decay. These are some of the research topics that deal with the drivers of Truth Decay. Normally, when people say, how do you know Truth Decay when you see it? I think of that as the trends that accompany it. And here are some of the trends. And so there's increasing disagreement about what is and what isn't factual. But related to that is this blurring of the lines between what is verifiable fact and evidence-based fact and anecdotes and opinions. Going along with that, there's an increase in the status that opinions have in our society. So one of the things I do with my daughter is I'll give her things to look at and I'll ask her, can you tell if this is someone who's writing as if they're writing this as an opinion or if they're writing this as if this is something that has been based on evidence? And it's not always easy because the conventions on how we write things is being hit with this. And a lot of people will create these opportunities to make folks see things that seem sensational, that seem interesting, that have a hot take attached to them, because they know that's going to drive traffic and eyeballs to that particular thing. So that increasing volume and influence of opinion and anecdote is also an issue. And the decline in what I'm going to call formerly trusted sources and facts is one of the other trends that we see that accompanies what this thing is that we're calling truth decay. So in addition to thinking about the drivers, you can think of them as causes, the trends which are pieces of evidence, these are the artifacts that sort of are left behind that let us know that truth decay is doing its work. We are also concerned with the We are also concerned with the consequences of truth decay. And this, to me, gets us directly to what we've been talking about in here. So I think ultimately if we don't do something about truth decay, it's going to screw with our democracy. And I'm not saying that to be hyperbolic. I truly mean that, and it worries me a great deal. There are folks who talk about this and who think about this a whole lot. I have two examples here. One's related to COVID disinformation, which was literally a matter of life and death. And the other example is a pretty common example that people think about when they think of this, and that's election denialism and January 6th being the, the boil that erupts on the body politic when it comes to all of that disinformation about the election outcomes and the legitimacy of the elections. I have a colleague at Penn State named Christopher Beam who talks about this in a more theoretical way, and I'm going to show you that YouTube clip because I think he says it a lot better than I do.
Democracy is premised. It assumes the idea that we are going to disagree. And if a society is free...
Sorry, y'all, bear with me.
Democracy is premised. It assumes the idea that we are going to disagree. And if a society is free, disagreement is inevitable and inescapable. And democracy sets up dialogue, debate, argument as a way for us to work through those disagreements. But that process only works if we reflect our positions honestly. If we lie, if we misrepresent what we think, then our dialogue isn't real. And when dialogue isn't real, argument becomes a waste of time. And when argument is a waste of time, then all we have left is raw power. In sum, in short, lies kill democracy.
That was worth the payoff, right? So yeah, so the what's the big deal implication of truth decay is that it gets at the foundation of what it means to live in a democratic republic. And truth telling and honesty and the ability to have discourse that's based on good faith acting is really, really important. It's not just important for public opinion's sake. It's not just important for campaigns. It's a national security issue. And it's also a global stability issue. And that's the reason why I sleep very little while I'm working at RAND. And that's the reason why I'm here trying to convince as many people as possible to help out in any way, shape, or form when it comes to promoting things that fight against truth decay. Now, beyond that, remember, truth decay is a system. And because it's a system, a lot of times when I say that I study it at RAND, people say, what's the difference between that? And then they'll use some other word. I like to think of it this way. As a way of understanding information exchange, truth decay has space in it to accommodate conversations about other stuff. For example, I like to think of these different words that people use to describe these things as having to do with two questions. Is the information something that can be verified or falsified? And whether or not that information is being transferred or spread or exchanged with malicious intent. If, for example, the information is not accurate, but it's not maliciously spread, we call that misinformation. It's kind of like an oops. But the intentionally spread, not correct stuff, we reserve the term for disinformation for talking about that stuff. So intention is a distinguisher between mis and disinformation. There's a version of this where information that is accurate is spread with malicious intent. My wife watches a lot of celebrity gossip news, and it's like when family-sensitive information shows up online or when people's addresses that should not be online show up online. The information is correct, but it's being spread with the intent of something negative happening as a consequence. We call that malinformation. And when you don't have malintent and you have accurate information, I'm just calling that proper exchange here. If y'all can come up with a better term, give it to me, right? Truth decay allows for conversations for all of this. Also, truth decay allows us to think about what we need to do to counter it. And my work as a political mobilizing scholar gets me to thinking about how we attack it, if you want to use that word, in different sectors of society. So RAND currently does a lot of work at the micro level and a lot of work at the macro level. So understanding how individuals process information and thinking about what that means. And on the other side of the extreme, thinking about how governments, the media, and big business can play a role when it comes to regulations that might encourage good acting and or discourage bad acting, right? I think a place where I can contribute to the organization is to think about this in the gray area. I'm going to call it the meso level here, where we're looking at community groups, indigenous groups, charitable organizations, faith-based initiatives, and foundations and stuff like that, because these middle ground areas, bigger than individuals but not quite traditional institutions, might be a way of helping out in the cause against countering truth decay. Last year, around this time, I was in Santa Monica, California, doing a workshop series about what people could do in their communities to become better prepared for what's going to come and to think about ways that they can help out their neighbors when it comes to thinking about countering truth decay. And literally, it was me thinking about how the meso-level activities can be added to the micro-level activities and the macro-level activities as a combined attack against these things related to truth decay. And finally, the efforts are important in general, but as we've been discussing here, those efforts can hit different communities in different ways. And so the disproportional impact of truth decay is a thing that's very important to me as a scholar of social identity. And I look at the idea that truth decay's impacts might be disproportionately harmful for certain segments of our population, and why it's very important to think about those segments of population when creating interventions. I have a colleague of mine that does some research on people over the age of 55 and how misinformation online needs to be intervened with and how traditional ways of intervening don't work for that particular population because they don't want things gamified and they don't want apps. They want different types of interventions and using cool and hip gadgetry to help out with misinformation in those spaces will not have the same effect as it would in other spaces. So I look forward to questions after this. Again, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about what I do and why I think it's important. And I look forward to the possibility of collaborating with people in the future. Thank you.
Good morning. Wonder, can you hear me? Am I turned on? And can you see me? Is this okay? I don't have slides. We may all regret that in a moment. But I thought if you could hear me, I'd start here. So I make certain assumptions about people who show up at 8:30 for a conversation about democracy. I assume you're all for it. It occurred to me during Professor Birch's presentation very early on, we saw some competing definitions of what's problematic and what we're fearful about within our democracy. And it occurs to me that at least part of the solution for our country is going to have to be a collective reckoning with a common definition of these things, just to agree generally on what the concepts are that we think are important and that make us distinctive. Because as you all know, if we can't agree on those type of common basic things, it's really difficult to take a step forward. I'm not going to say any more about that. We'll save that for the existential threats to democracy cocktail hour. But it's a thought that I had when I saw that slide. As a level set, I thought it might be helpful to say something about the organization I work for, the Southern Poverty Law Center. I'm out of our Mississippi office. We operate out of 5 states: Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, and recently, most recently, Washington, D.C. We started out as sort of a law firm, really, as a civil rights law firm. I first learned about the SPLC as a 10-year-old. I grew up on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and, Professor Philandra, we talked about lynching. There was a lynching that occurred in Mobile, Alabama in 1981 that was perpetrated by the Ku Klux Klan, the southern branch there in my neck of the woods. And Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center brought a lawsuit that finally went to trial in 87, verdict came down in 87, where they won against the Klan and then managed to bankrupt them. And so that made front page news on our local papers, and that got this 10-year-old's attention. And I remember talking to my dad, because we were big paper people at the time across our table, and saying, well, that's kind of interesting, suing the Klan. At that time, I don't think I even knew what a suit was or a lawyer was, but that left a mark. Now, in response to what we see as the changing place where these issues are playing out, it's not just in courtrooms anymore. It's in state legislatures. It's in neighborhoods. It's in city council races and things like that. We've diversified what we do. So we're not predominantly lawyers anymore, although I am licensed in practice. We're doing work in different places, and we try to think of our work in 4 categories. And democracy is at the very top of that list, strengthening democracy. We also think in terms of countering white supremacy, because for us, race is just at the center of most of this. We also think in terms of ending over-criminalization and mass incarceration. And then, of course, true to the second word in our title, trying to eradicate poverty. Again, just in terms of what we mean when we say these things, for us, when we say dealing with poverty, we think in terms of voter education. That's a big piece of it for us, is how do we, when we think about strengthening democracy, we think in terms of how do we make sure that voters are educated, not simply on the tangled thicket of some of the most complicated pieces of this, but just, do you know how to get registered? Do you know where your polling place is? Do you know when elections occur? Just in the 5 states we cover, the thicket of calendars and election schedules, it would blow your mind. We have a few off federal election year states, so they have their state and local elections on years that do not coincide with the federal government. In Louisiana, they have 2 election seasons depending on the size of your parish. And so on election year, you have some parishes who go to the polls in April, others who go in November. Those of you from Florida know y'all are voting every month of almost every year, depending on the office. And so for an organization that tracks that stuff, it really has kept us on our toes. But basic voter education is a piece of how we think we do this. And so sometimes it can just be as simple as, let us try to simplify some of these things. An increasing part of our work is trying to help people register as returning citizens. And what we mean by that are folks who are formerly incarcerated people trying to figure out what the rules are within their state and to move forward. And then, of course, I guess these are the sexier ways that you think about this work, fighting discrimination in the courtroom and in state capitals. So anyway, in response to this changing way that this stuff is playing out, we decided to develop a C4 operation over 10 years ago. That's where we house most of our lobbying groups. And so we have policy experts and lobbying teams that work in those states I mentioned a moment ago, and in some cases in concert with neighboring states. You know, I'm sure those of you who don't live in the Southeast think of the Southeast as a factory for bad ideas in the democracy space, and that's been true. I can confess it's certainly been the case. We are seeing more bad ideas coming out of the North and coming out of the West, And I'll tell you, one of the things I've observed to groups like this one is that as a native Mississippian, we've seen kind of the Mississippiization of the United States. And so y'all are starting to deal with some of the same policy and political realities that those of us who do this work have dealt with in the Deep South. And I will tell you, that is not an especially comforting fact. We would prefer that you keep your bad ideas to yourself. It just serves to make us a little bit more ridiculous. But let me tell you some of the trends that we see in the states that we observe and where kind of the energy seems to be at this particular moment with state laws that curtail voting. One of them is curbing access to absentee or vote by mail. Those of you who live in a state that has a robust vote by mail system, you might take this for granted. In a place like Mississippi and Alabama, there is no mechanism for voting early unless you have an excuse that comes in the form of some disability or some travel plan. So there's no real what we think of as no excuse early voting. And so we find ourselves working at a very basic level in many of our states just to figure out some concept that would allow someone to participate in their local government if they can't show up at a polling place between 7 and 7 on one Tuesday in November. Now, amazingly, even in places like Mississippi where you have to have your request for an absentee ballot notarized, and you have to sign it on the correct part of the envelope, and then it must be initialed by a clerk in your local circuit clerk's office, which, think about that as a college student. I've got about to be a college student. We've already started the conversation about absentee voting. Then when you get that ballot, to return it, it must also be notarized. So think about contemplating voting and access to voting in a place that makes absentee voting that hard. There's not a whole lot left you can do to us. It's pretty tough. But nonetheless, we saw a law passed in Alabama this summer which limits the number of absentee ballots that may be returned by one person. It's not uncommon in a nursing home setting or in other settings for someone to return multiple envelopes. It's not uncommon in a family setting for you to have a designated person that takes care of that. I'm sure those of you who live in places where there's vote by mail, it's not uncommon to have someone that takes care of the mailing process of that. So in Alabama, they've limited the number of actual envelopes that can be dropped. We can all think about how exactly you enforce something like that, but there's not, that's just the law as it stands now. Louisiana passed 5 new laws this spring that impact the way that voting works. Voter ID kind of got its start in the United States and North Carolina, quickly spread to who took that bill as a model into other states. It's become increasingly restrictive. Of course, we know that when you say to people need to show their ID at the polls, that's a pretty popular political idea in America. What I think people fail to recognize is that what's happened in some states is that it has just gotten increasingly and increasingly onerous, such that you can have a state-issued state driver's license, but if let's say you've moved and you didn't pay attention to that, if the address has changed, there are states that will not allow you to vote, and will discount that ballot. We're also seeing some states that are curtailing the number of different types of photo ID that may be used. So not only, some states don't accept a college ID, for example, which might be the only ID some people have. And as you all know, being lawyers, sometimes getting your license back, circumstances around immigration, various things can make having a state-issued ID a bit of a challenge and a nightmare, especially if something is going wrong in the interim. So we're seeing an increasing number of efforts to make that process more difficult. Voter assistance, we've seen states that don't allow you to have someone take you into the polls if you have a disability, just to help you navigate that system. Our organization brought a lawsuit along those lines in Mississippi, and ultimately were able to reach an agreement on some assistance. But, it just takes me back to that slide you showed me. What does it say about us if we're concerned that our friend with a disability can't have someone assist them in this. You know, whenever people tell me, well, we use voter ID as a no-brainer because we have to use an ID to do this, this, and this. Well, people with certain disabilities have friends that help them do a whole variety of things, and they might need it in the voting context as well. And so we see it there. Florida this year, and Florida is just a really interesting place. If you want to see where we have this real laboratory of weirdness, you can't hardly beat Florida. They passed a law that it doesn't keep you from having a voter registration drive. It doesn't prevent that. But if you send the voter registration packet back to the wrong county, it's a $2,500 fine per registration. Now, that's on the books. I can hear the lawsuits flying in, but that's on the books right now. Also, if you if there's some technical portion of it that you either don't complete or you complete incorrectly, like let's say you get somebody's address numbers wrong, that also can bring a fine. I think they cap those fines per entity, individual, or organization at $250,000. That's incredible. We talked about disenfranchisement a moment ago and you know, trying to bring people back into the voting, into voting after they've had their rights taken away. I thought it might be worth noting for you all that some states, including the ones that we monitor, still function under an 1890 Jim Crow Constitution. And so these are states that don't allow you to have your rights restored after you've served your time and paid your debt. These are places where the only way you get your rights back if you've committed certain felonies is by the legislature as a whole voting that individual back in, or the governor granting some type of relief. Look, I know we're towards the end of time. We want to leave time for questions. I wanted to flag just a couple things, because I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my friends in the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, who do a lot of work on hate and extremism. And they just released earlier this summer their annual, the Year in Hate and Extremism. I would commend that to you. It tracks the various anti-government. They divide it in a couple ways. Anti-government, those groups that seek to destabilize our government, particularly at the local level, is where we're seeing a rise in this. And then hate groups, those groups that are formed together solely on the basis of bias against particular individuals for all variety of things. I would just flag for you that our active anti-government groups in America have reached the number of 835. That's compared to 702 last year. And active hate groups in America is up to 595 from 523 last year. So wrapping up, I want to say, you know, you heard my title. I'm the political director. We are increasingly, organizations like mine are increasingly recognizing that it doesn't matter how good you might be in the courtroom or what type of lobbyist you might be, if you're dealing with an intractable judge or a legislator that is not going to hear you out. And so we are increasingly getting more involved in things like trying to recruit people to run for office, trying to demystify that thing for local folks, and trying to encourage candidates that do take pro-democracy stands and try to figure out how to provide eyeballs and resources to their work. I will tell you, we've created something called the Southern Local Election Dashboard because this information about local elections can be so hard to come by, because it can be so challenging just to figure out when your school board member is up or who your school board member might be. We've tried to pull all of that into one place. So it's the Southern Local Election Dashboard.org. It's called SLED, which is a weird name for a Southern group. We don't really have SLEDs or even know what they are. But this database, it's particularized in this way. What we have done is every political jurisdiction in our states that has a black voting age population of 40% and up, we've put in this thing. And then the purpose of that is because those are the populations where the news and information is least likely to be available, and where you're least likely to find websites at the county level that tell you when your elections are taking place, even websites that tell you who your current elected officials are. And so we make access to this database free, and we encourage people to use it, and we encourage friendly organizations and others, just to use it as a way of thinking about the way that you invest during election years, the ways that you figure out what communities to move in around voter education and things of that nature. So anyway, that's a little bit about how we look at this. It's a good thing to be with you this morning and appreciate your interest in this subject.
I'm going to see if I can synthesize some of these.
You want to answer your question while Tracy goes through those, maybe?
Sure. This question is for Ray, but anybody else. And that is, we see so much, whatever you call it, the lies of a part of disinformation, the lies on social media, and it spreads like wildfire. People are so quick to believe that. What would you recommend that our educational systems and our civic groups do to prepare people to be less willing to accept at face what they see on these social media?
So I feel like there are three things that I'm thinking of immediately. The first is we need to do like a landscape assessment of how people even think about this issue. Like, we care about it, we see it, right? We can see the foul play. There are a bunch of Rand, we call them Randites, people that work at Rand, who are looking at how worried regular folks are about online misinformation. And you can predict that they're not as concerned as we are, but they're pretty concerned, right? And we've noticed that they're... So there's moderate concern among rank and file folks about online misinformation, but there's a, I would argue, high confidence among individuals that they won't be run amok by it. And so one of the, it's a messaging issue right now. So like, we are worried about it. We want people to be more conscientious about it, and we're trying to convince people that they might want to get these trainings. And they might want to think about information literacy and be available to get more of that. So it is an information literacy issue, but it's also us messaging to convince people that this information literacy stuff is needed. And there are outlets for it. There are a lot of free things online and a lot of free things that RAND provides that help with this very thing. But if people don't think that they need to worry about it, I don't know how much it's going to hit home.
Okay, so I will just put three of these questions on the table because they kind of fit together. The first two are psychological in nature to the extent that one asks about political respect and the idea that people on the left had less respect for and less contact with people on the right. And how does this, and how does this idea of disrespect kind of go with the idea of misinformation, I guess, willingness to listen. Mm-hmm. The second question is about political involvement as therapy. Is that a significant motivation for people to get involved in politics? So I guess the comment on the ideas that about these psychological motivations for being amenable to political involvement and also to susceptibility to misinformation.
Wow. If no one's interested, I'll take that one.
I can take part of that
one. You first, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what we know from political psychology is that there is distance and animosity between partisans, but actually part of what's driving that is not people's own beliefs about the other party, but their perceptions about how the other party feels about them. So we call this a meta-perception because it is what I, as a Republican, think that the Democrats think about me or the Republican Party, and whether they are willing to be violent towards me, and whether they think that they are willing to harm me. So it is how I think about them. And studies show that when we convincingly explain to the other side that, look, no, your political opponents don't hate you, here are the data, where we ask them, hey, you Democrats, do you hate Republicans? And they say, no, we don't hate you. People become less negative towards the other side. So it's sort of not motivated by people's innate attitudes about the other party, but fears about how the other party is thinking about them. And that's the space where we have the opportunity to actually help out and change minds by actually quelling these fears that the other party really is not out to get you. And here are the data, and here is the information, and here is the people who are like telling you that, no, they're not out to get you. And that's an important distinction here. Yes, there is animosity, but it's not driven so much by people really not liking the other side. It's driven by fears that the other side doesn't like them.
That was great. Can I just say, you know, Ray and I were talking about the insular nature of some of these conversations. A lot of times we bring these topics up with people who we assume feel the same way that we do, which is natural. I mean, that's the nature of I'll just tell you, as a matter of personal discipline, and maybe it comes from being a person who does what I do in a state like Mississippi, I make sure to talk each week with folks who are different than me. And in fact, I'm an analyst on our local NPR affiliate, and I sit down with Haley Barbour's nephew once a week during the legislative session, and we talk about what just happened. And I can't tell you what a huge difference that's made in the way that I look and move and think about these things. So I don't know. That may sound a little Pollyanna, but seeking out people that are different than you and finding a way to have these conversations, I just don't know that there's any substitute for that in terms of changing and rewiring your brain a little bit in terms of how you approach other people.
Yeah. If I can add on, I'm piling on with the Pollyanna. So not only are these things super important, like the psychological makeup of how we think about enemies and friends, and the importance of us reaching outside of our comfort zones, I am a firm believer of pushing against the narrative that polarization is an unsolvable problem. Because if you believe that, then it basically, you mean some people are just going to think one way and other people are just going to think another. And I have examples from the COVID space where that's just not the case. The conventional wisdom is that if you look at a person's ideology and partisanship, you can predict how willing they are to mitigate. How, like, whatever that is, vaccine, social distancing, when it was a thing, masking, when it's a thing, right? And what we found is that that story is only true among people that don't think COVID-19 was a big deal. If you factor in how risky people perceived the thing to be, people on the proverbial left were just as likely to mitigate as people on the proverbial right. And that's a different story to tell than the story when you say that people on the left are more likely to mitigate than people on the right. What you should be saying is people on the left are probably going to have higher risk thoughts about COVID than people on the right. But once the risk thoughts get dangerous enough in people's minds, you don't see those partisan and those ideological differences. And so I spend a lot of time at RAND pointing out the common ground scenarios just to get people used to the idea that polarization doesn't always win, because there's a dominant story about how polarization beats everything else. And I just don't believe that. And there are evidence and anecdotes of when it doesn't actually happen.
I'm not sure what I know we're over time, but nobody's come to kick us out yet. So maybe do we have time for one more question? Okay, so I will then read one more question, and we won't be offended if people have to leave. But Has enforcement of criminal law violations kept pace with increased political violence and threats? And are you seeing better space for law and legal institutions for dealing with some of these problems?
There are gaps in the law that elected officials have highlighted that state legislatures are starting to address when it comes to political violence against them. One key problem is the fact that their personal information, their phone numbers and addresses, are public data the minute that they file for election. And states like New Jersey have acted to protect that data. There is a good reason why we, as a public, we need to know that an elected official actually lives in the state, because there have been cases where we're not sure where they live. But at the same time, having easy access to that information, that information often becomes available to people. The people get doxxed. It becomes available in the dark web, and then you have people showing up at private residences, having protests at people's houses, terrifying their significant others. So that is an effort that is being discussed actively at the state and local level, but only a couple of states have taken action on that. There are issues also with guns in public spaces after Bruin. It became far easier for people to bring firearms in public spaces. There are some limitations already put into from the Heller decision about sensitive places. There is a lot of litigation going on related to what's a sensitive place. And now also there are new efforts to limit the presence of firearms in public spaces, in political spaces. But there are still gaps in the law about things like that, which could allow people to bring, for example, firearms at protests. So that's an ongoing situation that a lot of states are involved right now, both in lawmaking and in active litigation over these issues.
On that point? Yes, on that point.
Brandon, I don't know if there's a rule or a law that says you can't make an active solicitation, but, you know, I think you ought to just, anybody who can contribute to your organization ought to do so. I know I've been a long-time contributor, and I can't think of money better spent than contributing to Southern Poverty, because I don't think there's a state in the country that doesn't have an aid group in it. So it's the whole of the United States, and you guys do such effective work, and at least bring it to the public knowledge.
I can't improve on that. That's outstanding. The only thing I would flag for you, let me just say this about that. You know, we're accustomed to giving to C3 organizations, and of course there are tax benefits from that. But I mentioned to you a moment ago that we've started a C4, the SPLC Action Fund, and we're not alone in that. There are a lot of organizations like ours. So I just wanted to make sure you all were aware that those dollars are so much harder to come by. And so some of that work is in its infancy. Whereas we think of the C3 established, and don't get me wrong, whatever it is you're doing, keep doing it. But I always want to remind people that those C4 dollars are so hard to come by, and they're certainly appreciated. And it's the reason why some of the work that we're talking about around the lobbying and some of the other types of voter education and advocacy is not quite as well developed as what we see in the C3 space. So anyway, thank you for that, and much appreciated, and just add that to it. Thank you.
I'll put out two more questions. One was specifically to me, asking if I was focusing primarily on battleground state eligibility requirements, and the answer is right now I've narrowed it down to two states that happen to be battlegrounds and one that's not, for comparison across different different kinds of electoral spaces. And one last question. Is the problem the rules or how those rules are applied to different populations? Is it like a situation where whites get treated, targeted with the same requirements as black people or other minority groups? I think that's to Brandon.
I think the answer is yes, Tracy. I think there's some problematic things working out in both sides. There's no question that the law is applied differently to people who look like me than to folks who don't look like me. It's just very hard to find data points that knock that truth off the pedestal. So there isn't an application thing. But what I hope you heard in some of the laws that I mentioned a moment ago, there's a suppression element in these that do a pretty good job of working with folks who aren't black and brown or women. And so some of the folks who we have represented in some of our states are white guys out of prison that are finding it impossible to not only get a job, but just to simply participate in the democratic process. So that's why I say yes to both. I mean, they have long done a great job of selectively applying laws to populations, but the laws are doing an increasingly good job of blocking everybody from fulsome participation.
That's all we have. Thank you all so much for your participation.